The Dagate. Moving on now to an introduction to the topic of the 36 tattvas, closely related, in fact, intimately related to the exposition of the Dragonfly Sutra. It turns out that the material relating to the sutra organizes itself into three sets. So there are three series of talks, units with some text and illustration. The first series has already begun, and this would be the first talk in the second series, dedicated specifically to this subject. Now, don't be put off by the technical jargon again. Using Sanskrit. 36 tattvas. Well, no need to stumble over the Sanskrit terminology or the Chinese or Japanese words that pop up here and there, as you'll see in a moment. No need to stumble over all of this jargon. In the exposition of the Dragonfly Sutra and everything that pertains to framing that instruction, these terms can, in the first place, be translated and explained in a simple and direct and user-friendly manner. And secondly, they can often be eliminated entirely and replaced by better terms. For instance, when you hear the 36 tattvas, you are hearing a certain number. There are 36 units or phases or stages of something. And tattva in Sanskrit can mean, for instance, a principle or a stage of action. What the Gnostics called the tattvas was hypostases. And a hypostasis, hypo means under or going down. For instance, if you have hypothermia, your temperature drops. And stasis means a state or condition or stage. So the hypostases, often mentioned in the Gnostic writings, are stages of stepping down, stages of reduction. And that is exactly the significance of the term tattva. So tattva in Sanskrit translates directly to hypostasis in Greek. But none of that is very helpful because we're not speaking Sanskrit or Greek here, and there's no need to get tangled up in those languages when it can all be said in a better way. So to introduce in this first talk of the second series, the subject of the 36 tattvas, you have this option. Use the term working parts. So if you have a carburetor of a car, you have a vacuum cleaner, you have any kind of simple mechanical device, a bicycle. A bicycle has working parts. The seat, the handlebar, the chain, the gears, the tires, the rim. The rims of the tires, the rims. These are all working parts. At some time or other in everyone's life, there's an occasion to see a schematic of working parts. So, for instance, most commonly, if you buy a blender with different attachments, it comes with a user's manual, you fold out a page, and there it shows you the 8 or 10 or 15 working parts of the blender. And the manual clearly labels them and names what they are, and perhaps gives you a brief description of their functions. The 36 tattvas are nothing other than working parts. But of course, the question arises, working parts of what? And the answer to that is also quite simple. They are the working parts of the dynamic field of cosmic projection. In Gaia Gnostic terms, aeonic projection. The sensorial world, the sensorial material world in which you find yourself, is a product of a dynamic field of aeonic projection. You can even say a mechanism. As a matter of fact, you can't do better with this concept than the analogy of a movie projector in a theater. This analogy serves beautifully for describing the mechanism of cosmic projection. So you'll find that it is used over and over again in this series two. So there is no better way to begin with consideration of the system of cosmic projection, which is called Vamana in Sanskrit, V-A-M-A-N-A, not to be confused with the well-known word Vimana, which refers to some kind of flying saucer-type vehicle or vessel that appears to have been described in some ancient Indian writings, such as the Mahabharata and the Ramayana. So the Vamana is the system of cosmic projection, which is in fact and in reality operating right now to produce the world event. World event means that which you see. It's not just the world as a social environment. It's not even just the natural world. It's the situation in which you find yourself on a planet, whatever a planet is, in a cosmic environment. And that entire cosmic environment and everything that is sensorially and materially present is a direct product of cosmic projection operating with 36 working parts. Bear in mind that a movie projector, professional movie projector that is in the projection booth of a theater, is a mechanical device. It's not an IT device. It's not electronic. It has electricity for the illumination of the projector bulb and to move the working parts of the machine and project the image on the screen. Such a machine, such a mechanical device, does not require IT or computers. So in approaching this subject, you do well to throw your mind back to that time when movies were shown in this way. Place yourself in a movie theater. There are seats on an incline facing a screen. The screen is vertical to the viewers, to the audience. It's a white vertical area where the projector displays the images on the film. So there you are sitting in a theater, an old-fashioned theater, and if you've ever done that, you might recall having, from time to time, turned and looked behind you. So if you turn and look behind you, what do you see? You look up the incline, the rows of seats, to the back wall of the theater, and the back wall of the theater is exactly parallel to the screen. So you are sitting between a horizontal surface in front of you where the image appears, the movie plays, and then there is, likewise, a horizontal wall behind you. And in that wall, as you turn around and crane your neck and look back, what do you see? Well, you see a slit. You see an aperture. You see a vertical rectangular slit. And in that slit, you see a light. And very often, or always, it appears that the light is flickering in some way. Every time that you put yourself, by an act of visualization, in the audience of a theater in this way, you're in an ideal position to grasp the lofty, sophisticated, and in some respects, extremely complicated system of intel that is comprised in the tantric Vedic system of the 36 tattvas. It's a system that has been discussed by many schools of Vedic philosophy and happens to be a subject of particular interest in Kashmiri Shaivism. So at some point, it might be appropriate to cite the source works there. But it's not necessary to go to those source works. This exposition of the 36 tattvas, or the cosmic projection system, with its working parts, doesn't require anything else to be valid. In fact, its validity is proven and authenticated, can be proven and authenticated, by the fact that there is no necessity to refer back to source materials. The description is new, is novel, and is complete and adequate unto itself. So you can breathe a sigh of relief on that point. So pick up the visualization again. Put yourself in a theater seat, looking at the screen, let's say before the movie has begun, a blank white screen, standing in front of you vertically. And you know that behind you is a wall which divides the theater from the projection booth, where the projector is located. Likewise, in the grand scheme of the 36 tattvas, you can distinguish between those working parts of cosmic projection that are on the other side of the wall of the projection booth behind you and what's in front of you, what in fact is coming from behind your head. So you have the term booth side, meaning in the projection booth, and theater side, meaning in the theater where you, the observer, are watching the movie. And that distinction, which is as simple as it gets, actually applies to the grand scheme of the 36 tattvas in this way. Only 13 of the tattvas describe actually what happens inside the projection booth. So those 13 factors describe actually the parts, the working parts of the projector, beginning with the projector light and the source of power for the projector light. Everything begins with the projector bulb, the projector light. The entire universe and the immediate material and sensorial world event that you are experiencing right now is produced by the 13 working parts of the cosmic projector, Vamana. On the other hand, in front of the wall of the projection booth, theater side, if you catch the jargon, there are 23 functions or particular activities that occur to assemble the movie of the world event, which is a 4D holographic projection, and you're in it. So once you grasp the simple analogy, the simple down-to-earth analogy of the projection booth and the theater, you begin to see immediately that there's something quite special about the theater. The process of projection in an ordinary movie theater is confined to the inside of the booth. A beam of light comes out of the aperture in the wall of the booth, and that beam of light carries the movie and projects it onto the screen. But in the cosmic projection event, it's a little bit different. In the cosmic projection event, everything that is on the theater's side of projection, including you, the viewer, and the audience, is a product of the 13 working parts of the projector machine. So the analogy is wonderful. It's so common, it's so common sense and simple. And yet, if you accept this analogy, you are immediately prompted to develop it and to see in a more subtle and sophisticated way how the action of cosmic projection actually occurs. And one of the first things that you realize is that in the cosmic projection of the 36 tattvas, which is one of the highest systems of Vedic tantric knowledge, in that system, everyone in the audience is likewise part of the projection that produces the film that is on the screen. So just take a moment and savor that delightful little notion. The technical term for that notion in mythology and cultural anthropology, the study of the complex and beautiful animistic systems of indigenous peoples, is participation. In an ordinary movie theater, you are not participating in the film, you're simply a spectator. But in cosmic projection, you are participating in the movie, and you in the audience, you the spectator, are as much a product of the cosmic projection device as the movie that you are watching. Clear enough? All right, so moving on now, as quickly as possible, as humanly possible, to set up the orientation that will allow you to grasp this immense cosmic system and eventually sharpen and enhance your awareness of being in this system, of being in the field of Vamana, of cosmic projection, of aeonic dreaming. Vamana is a Sanskrit word for aeonic dreaming in the Sophianic cosmology. So, moving on with this description, which, by the way, is novel and unique to the instruction that comes with the Dragonfly Sutra and has never, ever been made before in the way it's being made now. Moving on with its description, it's helpful to just shift the topic for a moment to a second issue. And this second issue is really important in the orientation to the mystery of cosmic projection. And it concerns the definitions and the accounts and claims that have been made by those who have apparently fathomed the deepest operations of cosmic projection. So at this point, and again, this is an extremely helpful clarification, there are five terms to consider in Sanskrit, Chinese, and Japanese. But once these terms are set out and translated, it's no longer necessary to refer to these terms except for two of them, which are really user-friendly and easy to remember. So the five terms are samadhi, that's a Sanskrit word, satori, that's a Japanese word, wu, that's a Chinese word, which is actually equivalent to the Japanese satori, kensho, another Japanese word that you might encounter, which is dispensable, not essential, and the triple term, anuttara samyak sambodhi, which is a Sanskrit term. Oh, and this other term ought as well to be added, nirvana. So these are the terms that can really get in the way and be stumbling blocks to a direct and comfortable comprehension of aeonic dreaming. The subject here is aeonic dreaming. Why then introduce these terms, these troublesome terms in other languages? Well, they are the terms that survive, rather like driftwood that floats up on the beach. Are they flotsam or are they jetsam? They are terms like driftwood that flows up on the beach, coming out of the surf and coming out of the tide. And what is the surf and the tide? Well, it is the tremendous accumulation, building the momentum of the entire history of the mystical experiences of the human animal. To put it in plain English, various mystics, yogis, mahatmas, sadhus, sannyasins, various masters, whether they be Chan masters or Zen masters, various gurus of the Vedic tradition, individuals such as Yogananda, his teacher, Sri Yukteswar, Satchitananda, who was a pop guru of the 60s, Muktananda, Ramakrishna, these are names of more or less recent cases. One can then go back into the record to discover the names of certain individuals, such as Prince Siddhartha, Gautama, the historical Buddha, and Shankaracharya, and other great saints and mystics of the past. And what do all of these characters have in common? Associated with them, with their names and with their histories, is the claim that they, in some manner or other, penetrated into the depths of the dynamic field of the working of cosmic projection. Do you see that? And how did they do so is one question, of course. What techniques did they use? And secondarily, what types of experiences did they have? Now hold that second question for a moment. Let's suppose that in some cases, these psychonauts, that's a good collective term for them, the Vedic yogis, Buddhic masters, these psychonauts looked into the depths of cosmic projection. They looked into the hidden activities that produced the world movie. But they did so in two different ways. In one instance, they looked at the forward 23 phases of cosmic projection that are on theater side. That is to say that their expanding consciousness, their heightened awareness of cosmic reality, only extended to the wall of the projection booth and to the aperture where that light flickers. But others went into the projection booth and they explored the working parts of the cosmic projector in the booth, in the projector itself, to the point where they arrived at the light source and power source for the entire process. Now, those are two different areas of mystical exploration, two different areas, two different categories of mystical illumination. Yes. One category of mystical illumination only goes as far as the wall of the projection booth. The other category goes into the depths of the projection mechanism to its source. And that source is typically called by various names in the Indian and Vedic systems: Parasamvit, Brahman, Shiva. It has various names which all refer to the ground of absolute reality, the primordial ground consciousness, Parasamvit. And that term refers to the light source and the electrical or power source that runs the entire system of projection. Now, if you return to those terms I described, you can select two of those terms, Satori and Samadhi, and you can apply them to mystical illumination on the theater side. That's Satori. Then you can apply them to mystical illumination on the projector side, on the other side of the projection booth, behind the audience, behind that wall. And the term that applies to that genre of mystical illumination is Samadhi. So Samadhi and Satori are not the same. They are not the same and cannot be identified and equated. Basically, the difference is this. If you go through that vertical window, up the projector beam, and directly into the mechanism of the cosmic projector, you cannot function in the normal and natural world. So the only way that anyone has ever been able to access those 13 working parts is by going into a catatonic trance. So Samadhi is a high trance of illumination in which the yogi reaches the direct experience and the direct workings of the cosmic projection system. On the other hand, Satori occurs theater side. And since you, sitting in the theater, are both a spectator, a member of the audience, and a participant in the world movie, then you are in a position to have an entirely different experience of illumination of the tattvas that are operating, the 23 of them, that are operating theater side. You see? Once you have this distinction, you'll find that it is extremely useful in trying to interpret any reports of mystical illumination. They may be reports coming from Vedic yogis, some of whom are alive today, and you can watch them and hear them talk on the internet. And presumably these Vedic yogis, Mahatmas, have spent at some point some hours or days or years in samadhi, which is a catatonic, dysfunctional condition of paralysis and deep trance. Satori, on the other hand, is a condition of illumination in which you can be active and you can function normally like anyone else walking around in the world event. Once you have this distinction on board, and be assured that this is veracious, reliable, consistent, and will always be helpful in your attempt to figure out what these mystical experiences were all about, okay? Once you have the distinction in mind, you can ask the question regarding the historical Buddha, Prince Siddhartha, Shakyamuni. Well, did he experience samadhi or satori? Well, the Buddha did not experience samadhi. Buddha's illumination belongs to the theater side of the cosmic projection event. So does the illumination, the classical instances of illumination recorded in Chan and Zen tradition are examples of illumination on the theater side. There are great problems with the illumination said to have been experienced by the historical Buddha. As a matter of fact, if you hold to this distinction, you can make a critical assessment of what the Buddha experienced in this way. You can say that the Buddha only experienced mystical illumination of cosmic projection up to the aperture in the wall of the projection booth. Yet, he assumed, and those who followed him assumed, that his experience went fully into the depths of the projection event, into samadhi. That is not true. The state that the Buddha achieved under the Bodhi tree at the moment of his enlightenment, as the fairy tale goes, was merely a state of quasi-samadhi. That is to say, he sat there in a meditative trance. But as a matter of fact, the Buddha did not realize anything about the 13 working parts of cosmic projection. And there is nothing about them in Buddhist teachings. Nothing whatsoever. So what the Buddha taught was something really perverse and deviant. This is where the word nirvana comes in. But you know, there's something confusing and misleading about the traditional description of the Buddha's enlightenment. On the one hand, it is claimed that he achieved enlightenment. Well, how do you define the enlightenment he achieved? On the other hand, it is claimed that he reached nirvana but did not enter it. So what is the connection between achieving enlightenment in the way that Siddhartha did under the Bodhi tree and attaining nirvana? Well, attaining nirvana has absolutely nothing to do with achieving an illumined view of cosmic projection. The goal of nirvana is to annihilate desire and to annihilate the flux of thoughts in the mind. To still the mind and annihilate desire is nirvana. So it is said that the Buddha attained nirvana, but as an act of compassion did not enter into nirvana, which would have been an act of self-annihilation equivalent to a living death. Rather, he chose to stay in touch with the world so that he could propound his teachings. So the Buddha's attainment of nirvana, which is the cessation of desire and the flux of mental formations called vikalpa or chittavritti, well, that's one thing. That is an attainment that he may have indeed achieved. But it has nothing to do with Satori and the illumination of the 23 aspects of cosmic projection theater side. So it may be questioned whether the historical Buddha achieved enlightenment at all. How does anyone know that Buddha actually attained enlightenment? Well, it depends, of course, upon how you define enlightenment. And according to the definition that's being introduced and developed here, he most certainly did not. Those who attained enlightenment were characters like Bodhidharma, who is said to have brought Buddhism from India into China, and those Chan and Zen masters of the subsequent tradition. They actually provably experienced enlightenment. There is nothing in the teaching of the historical Buddha, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Noble Path, the teaching of Shunya or Shunyata, the identity of form and void. There is nothing in those teachings that provide reliable evidence of an experience of enlightenment. Now, to conclude this talk, let's focus for a moment on the concept of Satori, which is often translated as sudden enlightenment. Satori belongs to the tradition of non-attained realization. The Vedic yogi tradition puts the emphasis not on sudden illumination, theater side, but on the deep, deep awareness of cosmic projection that can only be attained by going into ecstatic catatonic trance and exploring how things work projector side. Were on a path of attainment. They practiced rigorous discipline in order to enter samadhi, and then they achieved a particular form of illumination typical of samadhi. In fact, if you work these two distinctions between samadhi and Satori, it becomes clear, more or less rapidly, that what the Buddha attained was neither chalk nor cheese. It was neither one nor the other, but a sort of confused mélange of the two, and on top of that, it incorporated this notion of nirvana, and nirvana has nothing to do with enlightenment. You see, nirvana is something that can be achieved by suppressing desire and suppressing the citta vritti, the modifications of the mind. So if you reach complete cessation of the mind, no mental activity, and you also suppress and eliminate desires so that you feel no desire whatsoever, that's nirvana. That state does not confer any kind of enlightenment or illumination whatsoever. It is a state of voluntary self-annihilation. And bear in mind, while you're savoring that point, the fact that a yogi or monk whose meditation techniques allow him to suppress desire, to annihilate desire, which is one of the objections of Buddhism, as well as to still the productions of the mind, the activity of the mind, the meditation techniques that would allow a monk to do that do not in any way grant the illumination of Satori. This enlightenment that comes with the Dragonfly Sutra is an illumination like Satori. It is a Chan Zen type of non-attained realization. That being so, it becomes obvious that two of the classical imperatives of Buddhism do not apply to the Dragonfly Sutra. No, you do not deny and suppress desire. You do not regard desire as the root of all suffering, which is an absurd and biophobic notion. Secondly, you do not achieve Satori by suppressing and entirely eliminating the productions of the mind, the mental flux, the coming and going of ideas. Rather, you simply accept them and observe them. There is nothing to eliminate. There is nothing to suppress. On the contrary, Satori, in this enlightenment, comes with the observation of the automatic and spontaneous activity of the mind. And that is such. So that would conclude this first unit in series 2 on cosmic projection. Tathagatay.